me.
Ryan, Christy had told us you were on your way, but I dared not.
There'll be time for reunions later. Now we've got to get out of here before this guard wakes up. Bloodsniffer entered.
Damn. It's that double-crossing wolf. What's it doing here?
Helping us. Christy, tie up and gag the boy. Mildred joined Christy in doing so, both somewhat surprised that Ryan had let the boy live. They tore strips from the boy's breech clout to fashion a gag. Mildred quickly knotted the thongs that had previously bound the friends and hogtied the young man, ankles to wrists. JB and Doc eyed Bloodsniffer distrustfully and not a little fearfully.
Joe's got our blasters. He's been trying to train his warriors how to use them.
I figured. Let's get them back.
Outside again, Bloodsniffer followed the odor of gun oil and cordite through the dark avenues, and the companions followed at his heels. The wolf went to the monstrous tree that had served as their guest quarters. While the humans waited in the underbrush, the animals circled the great trunk, casting for a scent of guards. After one circuit, Bloodsniffer paused before the archway, looking back toward the companions.
Let's go.
They crept inside, the wolf pausing every few feet to sniff the air. The corridor was empty. They came to a small room and found Joe and Little Mountain. They had a jug of liquid before them, and their faces in the flaring lamplight weren't the faces of happy men. Laid neatly on a low table against the far wall were all of the companions' weapons, including Jack's knives, Doc's sword stick, and the rucksack containing ammunition. Joe's rifle rested at the edge of the table, within easy reach. Bloodsniffer entered first.
Don't move.
Ochine, I'm gratified you still live, but not gratified you sold us out to the wolf soldiers.
Little Mountain looked from Ryan to the wolf with fear-whitened eyes.
It's no sin to betray a betrayer, as Shishoka said.
I didn't betray you.
You kept us in the dark about what this conflict is really about. You'll bring death to this valley because of some dream, some theory you cooked up based on nothing but bitterness and ego.
You've been seduced by Shishoka.
Joe, you're going with us to Shishoka.
Pizzi will kill me.
Probably. I don't know if you deserve it or not. But I do know that you're the man who brought war to this valley, and you brought us here to help you wage it.
You came here for gold. If you turn on me now, you'll lose it all.
Don't be so sure all white men are as greedy as history makes us out to be. Now, both of you, let's go.
Go where?
To get horses. When we go out, keep it looking natural and friendly. Just a friendly stroll with the Wishikankagas. No talking unless I ask you a question. You fuck with me, I'll chill both of you where you stand.
Joe exchanged a quick look with Little Mountain, nodded brusquely, then moved toward the door. All of them filed out into the corridor, and then into the brooding, quiet night.
Who seduced you?
I'll tell you later.
They reached the compound, which was unguarded, though Bloodsniffer's ears were pricked up, and he stared around as if sensing something that couldn't be seen. While Joe and Little Mountain were held at gunpoint, Christy, JB, Doc, and Mildred selected the mounts from the others and put pad saddles on their backs. Christy picked out a sturdy pony for Ryan. Mildred handed Joe the lead rope of his pinto.
This one's yours. Don't try anything.
You're making a mistake, Ochine.
Maybe. Maybe I'm trying to correct one.
Joe reached out to pat his pony's velvety muzzle. Abruptly, Bloodsniffer stiffened, hackles rising.
Kichi's up there!
The pony instantly reared up, hooves and forelegs lashing out. The horses panicked, forcing the companions back. In the chaos, both Joe and Little Mountain squirmed away and bolted.
Fire blast.
The whole place is waking up.
Ryan grabbed the bridle of the pony Christy had chosen for him.
Everybody get on a horse, now!
They drummed up the avenue and veered toward the open plains. Glancing back once, Ryan saw warriors darting for ponies, trying to calm them enough so they could be saddled and ridden. All six people let their horses run flat out across the grassland for 5 miles. Only when the black woods rose before them did they slow the horses to a canter. Bloodsniffer had dropped back due to his injured leg, and Ryan waited until the wolf had trotted up.
I don't think they chased us.
There must be a reason.
He's warning his pack of something.
Ryan glanced behind him, but saw nothing but the nighted plains. The wolf trotted toward the forest.
All right, everybody. The wolf leads.
They followed him, the wolf loping ahead. Miles later, when they struggled up the hill to the crest, they found Peasy and Shishoka waiting for them.
Shishoka, I'd like you to meet...
It has begun.
What?
Smell the air.
Smoke. Looking back in the direction they had come, they saw pinpoints of flame dancing at the far edge of the dark forest.
The doom you helped bring here is sweeping toward us, Outlander.
Ryan didn't know what to say. He simply stared at Peasy and Shishoka. She waved a hand toward the distant crags and peaks.
You are free to leave Tarawa, all of you. The packs guarding the pass are being recalled, so none will molest you.
No, I'm staying. I'll try to undo what we helped create here.
Ryan gazed at his friends.
This is my decision alone. The rest of you can get to the pass, and I'll join you when I can.
You can't make that decision only for yourself, Ryan. Anything and everything that any one of us chooses to do affects the others. You know that. We came here together, and we'll leave together. Or not at all.
Yeah. Well, as long as we don't have to fight wolves.
They'll fight with us, won't they?
Yes, Ryan Cawdor. They will be your allies. Your help can be valuable in this hour.
Peasy, what's he saying?
He tells the pack leaders that the Outlanders fight with the wolf soldiers. They will pass it along to those beyond hearing range.
Ryan looked again at the forest. He could see tendrils of smoke curling into the sky and dancing orange flames.
That fire will be here in a few hours, and Touch the Sky and his warriors will come after it.
Yes, we hope to stop it. While you were gone, our people have labored to cut a firebreak on this side of the river.
If those dry woods get going, no firebreak will stop it. It'll jump, maybe even jump the river. You gotta start a backfire.
Use fire as a defense against fire? Our people will not like it.
Either that, or the blaze will burn your encampment to the ground by midnight.
You're sure about this?
Yes.
Then I will give the order. Follow me.
They started down the ridge toward the river, leading their horses. Shishoka and Peasy walked ahead of them.
Joe said he could put only about 300 warriors into the field. What's our ammo situation?
I checked on the way through the woods. All of us, except your pistol and my Uzi, average about 20 shots per blaster. Joe and his idiots burned up a lot of rounds today.
Doesn't sound like we can afford to fire warning shots.
But your experience of war will be invaluable to us. We know little of war in Tiratwa. We wolf soldiers have not had to fight in over a century, perhaps longer.
I fear, you may make up for 100 years of lost bloodshed before this night is over.
The whole sky over the ridge was a wall of black smoke, laced with livid, blood-red flame. The flames were eating through the forest and scorching their way up the hill. Smoke rolled densely, blotting out the stars. The air was thick with it. Peasy, Ryan, JB, and Christy stood at the firebreak the people of the encampment had been digging for hours. It was a ragged 100-foot lane, cut only a few yards from the riverbank.
This is never going to stop a forest fire.
That's what the backfire's gonna be for. Stop it before it jumps the river.
Ryan and JB supervised the task of starting the backfire. Their torches kindled the dry brush all along the ridge facing the fire lane. Undergrowth, cedar, and fir blazed up, and the edge of the lane became a new wall of flame, moving up the hill toward the oncoming fire.
It's moving up!
Yeah, it's looking like it might hold it off.
Let's get across the river. See how Mildred and the others are doing. Peasy! Peasy, are you okay?
My side hurts.
Your side? Oh, Peasy, you're bleeding. You've been shot. Everybody down!
Looking upriver, Ryan saw the first of a score of bark and hide canoes loaded with warriors emerging from the pall of smoke. From the prow of one of the lead canoes was Joe, his automatic rifle at his shoulder. Ryan clenched his teeth. He should have realized that Joe's only possible strategy was to use the river as a safe highway behind and past the conflagration he'd set. He had probably seen them setting the backfire and swung through the screen of smoke while they were occupied. Ryan unholstered his stire.
Christy, get Peasy out of here.
What about you and JB?
We'll be fine.
Miniature water spouts spewed in front of the canoes, and the flotilla was rowed toward the bank. Christy managed to edge the wounded Peasy off the bridge and onto solid ground. She tried to support him as they ran toward the encampment.
Get the wolf soldiers!
JB and Ryan kept up a sporadic fire, hoping to keep Joe and his warriors from leaving the sheltering foliage at the edge of the river. Beasts and men clad in beast skins ran across the open ground, swinging knives and tomahawks and holding crossbows. Ryan and JB were forced to stop shooting as the wolf soldiers in the packs crashed through the brush and trees at the edge of the red-lit river. The wolf soldiers ran up and down the riverbank, their lances stabbing, their arrows flying, fangs tearing, claws flaying. They fought breast to breast with their brothers from the forest city. Great, shaggy bodies leapt and rolled and slashed and clawed. Bodies fell on the banks or splashed into the shallows. The warriors fought over them, treading faces with their feet, slipping on blood and viscera.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Ryan and JB, watching from the bridge, were held in a horrid fascination. Lit by the leaping, doubting flames from the forest and the backfire, the scene took on an unreal, deranged, almost hallucinatory quality, like something out of jolt-inspired dementia.
Hate to say it, but we don't have the ammo to back our men up.
No. Defending the village and the cave is our priority. Let's head back.
They left their spot, running toward the encampment. Halfway there, they met Jack, Doc, and Mildred. Christy and Shishoka were kneeling beside the fallen Peasy.
Shishoka, make sure...
Peasy, you're going to be fine.
No. Ryan Cawdor, your heart is true.
Thank you, Peasy.
I only pray it will be enough.
Peasy.
What was it? Oh, shit.
The backfire's not working.
Joe's whole strategy was just to buy time, to keep the wolf soldiers from fighting the fire.
Shit. The fire will be into the camp in an hour. We've got to retreat.
It was the death rite of warriors who courted death in order to deal death. Blind, panting, and merciless. Back and forth the battle rolled, blades sinking into chests, blood spurting, feet churning the ground into crimson sludge. The Gewehr sent wolf soldiers to the dirt with each round. Joe's warriors were outnumbered, but the effect of his automatic rifle was devastating. Ryan saw him moving through the whirling, eddying mass of men and animals, shooting and clubbing. Again and again, a wolf soldier who heaved a tomahawk or lance at him found a bullet in his head or chest before he could strike. Arrows missed Joe as he moved like a lithe phantom panther. Then the wave of combat surged and spilled away from the riverbank and spread out across the smoky, flaming ground. Ryan, Shishoka, Christine, JB, Mildred, Doc, and Jack ran toward the nearest ring of teepees. Great scorching winds whipped behind them, flinging blinding smoke into their path. Sparks and embers whirled in corkscrew patterns through the air.
Shishoka, tell everyone to get out of the camp. The fire will be here in an hour. Touch the sky and half that.
She rushed off, quickly informing the village of what had happened. When she came back a few minutes later, the entire population was getting their gear together.
It is done. They wanted to stay to avenge Peasy, but I told them there would be time for that later.
Exactly. Joe won't wait for the fire to burn down the encampment before he makes his move for the cavern. That's where we'll stop
him. You cannot enter the cavern?
Maybe not. But Touch the Sky thinks he can. We'll lay in wait for him outside of it.
Now I see. Come.
Ash fell like a dingy snow, and the wind was so hot they felt its breath burning their skin. Behind them, the flames leapt triumphant, flaring in great twisting tongues from the treetops, dancing. They reached the crude fence where they had corralled their horses.
Ryan, I will ride with you. I will show you the way.
Right.
Go! This way!
Pushing their horses into a gallop, they raced up the slope toward the tumble of huge boulders at the barren base of the mountain ramparts. Amidst the rock tumble, they saw the throbbing, pulsing light. Behind them, the outer ring of the Hidenwood structures erupted into flame, blazing like huge torches. Turning slightly, Christy tried to focus on the wavering luminescence from the mouth of the cavern.
The rest of the way is not for horses. We go by foot.
Then let's do it.
The group wended their way through the shadows, creeping among the looming masses of stone, keeping their eyes on the glow from the cave opening. They moved into a fissure splitting a monstrous rock, so narrow they walked in single file. Ponderous chunks of half-dislodged granite hung over them. They made their way with extreme care, knowing how easy it was to start a slide by accidentally kicking a keystone.
We are getting closer to the cave. It's me he really wants. Perhaps I can convince him to let all of you go.
And take the location of this magic valley back to the world? Oh, not very likely, child.
Our only escape route is the cave.
My strategy exactly.
Oh, I have no choice. Even if I surrendered to touch the sky, he would still defile the sacred place.
And let's move on it, not staying around talking about it.
They moved deeper into the twisting labyrinth, squeezing through narrow places and clambering over heaps of shale, scrambling for footholds on chunks of granite and sandstone. Sidling around the bulging base of a boulder, they faced the cavern entrance. It was smaller than Ryan had estimated, a cleft wider at the bottom than the top, seemingly punched into the mountain wall. A narrow stair of handholds had been niched into the rock, extending upward to a shelf-like threshold 10 feet above their heads. The wavery glow from inside the cleft was a bluish fog, more like a phosphorescent mist than an actual light. Everyone stopped to stare for a long moment. Then, Shishoka moved forward. The others followed, scalps tingling at the prospect of entering the cave. Suddenly, a dark shape bounded from a patch of gloom between the rock.
Whoa!
Bloodsniffer walked out from the darkness, glanced at Ryan, and showed his fangs and red tongue in a grin.
Oh, damn wolf again. I'd hoped it had been killed.
Ryan eyed Bloodsniffer and saw that the beast had only narrowly avoided that fate. A bleeding gash stretched along its right side, and a red-rimmed notch had been chopped into the base of its tail, probably with an axe. Still, the wolf's condition and spirit seemed sound.
Shit! He's here! You people go!
But...
Now!
I have...
Ryan and Jack opened up with their weapons, providing covering fire for the others as they scrambled up the stairs chiseled into the rock. Surprisingly, JB helped Bloodsniffer climb the niches by pushing him upward with a shoulder against his rump.
All right, Jack, they're up. Come on!
Ryan scaled the steps as quickly as he could.
Ryan, over here! Hide!
Is everybody okay?
Yeah. Where's Jack?
I'm here.
Jack, get over here!
Jack ran stiffly to the companions, his right hand covered in blood.
Jack, what happened?
Yeah, failed a sting on my hip.
I'm gonna have to take a look, Jack. Drop your pants.
What?
Do it, Jack.
No.
Shishoka, what are they saying?
Touch the sky is... He's having difficulty convincing his warriors to follow him into the cave. They're arguing.
We need to get on the move before the argument is resolved.
I agree. How's he looking, Mildred?
Not too bad, actually. The bullet exited his hip above his right buttock. It's deep, sheared through some muscle, and might have cracked the bone. You can pull your pants up now, Jack.
Jack, can you walk?
I can walk. Sure.
Then let's go.
They moved out, Shishoka in the lead, striding quickly along the stone passageway, peering through the dim, misty blue light. The corridor widened, and the ceiling grew in height. Irregular stalactites stretched from above, and they wended their way around, stalagmites thrusting up from the floor. Ryan kept listening for the approach of Joe and his warriors. The light was confusing. It was just bright enough for them to see a few feet in front of them, but too dim to make out shapes clearly.
Stop!
Hey!
Sorry. Why'd we stop?
Dropping to all fours, Shishoka crept forward, her hand groping through the bluish mist. Ryan and Doc stepped forward and knelt beside her. Ryan experienced a shuddery sensation of imminent peril. He stretched out his left hand and found that the tunnel floor dropped straight down into the misty light.
Whoa. No floor.
This friendly pebble will tell us how far the fall will be. One, two, three, four, five. No, thank you, sir, indeed.
We'll have to make our stand here.
As Doc backed away, something brushed the top of his head, hanging from above.
Oh, look at this.
It was a length of frayed rope, and they craned their necks to look up to see what it was anchored to. The end of the rope was lost in shadows. Ryan reached up and tugged gingerly on the length of hemp. Nothing happened, so he pulled harder.
It's attached to something, all right.
A long, flat slab descended from the rocky ceiling. The slab was made of rough-hewn splintering timber and lashed together with rope. It was a bridge, affixed to the tunnel roof by a pulley system of some kind. The bridge lowered until its outermost edge rested on the tunnel's lip, spanning the chasm.
Who wants to take the first step?
Before anyone could reply, Shishoko stepped cautiously on the bridge. She walked quickly across and was swallowed up by the mist.
Shishoko?
Everything's fine. This is the way.
Unhesitatingly, Bloodsniffer trotted across. One at a time, as if they were walking on eggshells, everyone soft-footed across the bridge. Ryan went last, guarding their rear. When the others had safely crossed, he followed.
Everybody okay?
There's no rope on this side. We can't raise the bridge to keep Joe from crossing.
He has no choice if he wants us. We can just stay here and pick him and his warriors off as they come across.
No! You cannot kill in the heart of the Grandmother! Not in the Cavern of Creation!
If we don't, we'll all die.
No! Find another way.
There is another way. Jack, since you're the lightweight among us, you can ease out on the bridge and cut the rope supporting the timbers. It won't be able to support another crossing.
Well, that tactic will leave us stranded here, perhaps to wander the subterranean rings of Hades for all eternity, like Virgil.
Jack?
Huh?
Do it.
Jack nodded and crept back out across the bridge. After a moment, he returned, backing up on hands and knees.
Done.
The seven people and the wolf walked quietly away from the chasm. They heard nothing for a few minutes. Then...
Nice work, Jack.
Their path took them along the edge of a jagged rock wall on their right, but on their left was an unplumbed darkness dropping to inconceivable depths. JB peered into the abyss.
Kind of makes you want to spit, doesn't it? Wait a second. I can see some kind of light down there.
Ryan and the others moved cautiously to the edge and gazed into the dark void. A faint greenish glow filtered from far beneath, flickering in a rapid, almost hypnotic rhythm.
That must be the source of the light.
Light in here is blue, dead green.
See that strobing pattern? Any light source pulsing at a high speed is redshifted on the electromagnetic spectrum. Blue becomes green, yellow becomes orange, green becomes yellow.
So?
So nothing. Let's go.
The path wound downward, slanting steeply. The throbbing green glow shone far in the distance. The tunnel bent to the right, shrinking to only a dozen feet wide. Almost immediately, it opened up again into a hollow chamber.
Oh, Nanabozo.
The chamber was a catacomb, or a vast crypt. Around them were hundreds, maybe even thousands, of animal and human remains. Most were skeletons. Others appeared to be completely fossilized. There were other skeletons that appeared more recent, scattered close to the entranceway. Dozens of skulls bore backsloping foreheads with barred ridges jutting out over empty eye sockets. All of the skeletons were bare. The flesh that once covered them long ago disintegrated.
Fire blast.
Gaia. This is a cemetery.
Or a charnel house.
Shishoka, what is this place?
This is where the first people worshipped the Grandmother and made their sacrifices to her. Where they came to die.
Oh, wait. So everybody comes here and then just ups and... Oh, sorry.
JB, try not to step on the skulls.
We cannot go back. As disrespectful as it sounds, we must pass across the remains of the departed.
Don't bother me.
The party moved through the catacomb, trying not to step on bones, but it was almost impossible. The farther they walked, the fewer skeletal remains they encountered. The chamber opened up into a vast cavern, a city of stalagmites and stalactites. Towers of multicolored stone disappeared into the darkness above, where flying buttresses and graceful arches of rock stretched overhead. There were the marks of pickwork in the walls, and the light reflected dull yellow gleams. With every step, the floor became more level, as though by design. The green light grew brighter, until it was at the level of twilight on an overcast day. They could see easily now, their vision no longer obscured by the phosphorescent mist. Here and there, they saw cavities gaping in the wall and floor, and a scattering of crystal shards. They saw petroglyphs painted on the walls, ancient word pictures in the form of incomprehensible murals. The level floor ended abruptly in a series of stair-like steps, chiseled out of the rock, leading downward through a round orifice. The green glow pulsed from its other side, like brilliant, cool moonlight. Shishoka hesitated, exchanging a quick look with Ryan. Then she carefully walked down the steps. Bloodsniffer followed at her heels. The stairs ended in an enormous chamber, so vast they could only see part of it at one time. It was shaped like an upside-down bowl, with smooth, curving walls. The party stood on a narrow stone walkway encircling the entire circumference of the cavern. They jolted to an unsteady stop, blinking and shaking their heads, trying to absorb the unreality of what they were seeing. The walls were patterned with thick, sinuous veins of gold and silver. The floor was scattered with heaps of rough nuggets, smoothly finished ingots, as well as bracelets and artfully fashioned figurines. There was a quartz crystal cluster the size of a child's head, sitting atop a pile of golden pebbles. The floor inclined in a gentle curve, and at the center, surrounded by a collar of interlocking silver and gold slabs, was a perfectly round hold. Ryan guessed it to be 50 feet in diameter. A terrific blaze of green light shimmered from below the collar of metals, almost painful in its intensity. The light was a shifting, dancing column that appeared to swirl, to twirl, to shrink, then grow. In the steady, unearthly blaze, all of them saw things that astounded and bewildered them. On the floor, arrayed around the well of light in a circular pattern, were wafers of gold, some studded with single crystals, others with three or four. Several of the rectangles were missing, showing the rock beneath. Either the weight of ages had pushed them out, or greedy human fingers had pried them loose. Ryan tore his gaze away from the glittering splendor of the dancing light and looked up.
Fire blast.
On the far side of the well, in a place that the shimmering radiance had first hidden from him, reared a five-tiered ziggurat of silver-encrusted stone. Atop the ziggurat sat an effigy gazing down at him, causing his flesh to crawl and his mind to reel with impossible possibilities. Christy, Doc, Jack, Mildred, JB, and Shishoka also stared, stunned, shocked, awed, and terrified. Enthroned in a massive chair that looked to be fashioned from gold was the huge, skeletal figure of a man. On closer inspection, they saw that the figure wasn't quite a skeleton, nor quite a man. No man, at least none that they had ever seen, even in the most rad-blasted hell pits of Deathlands, had ever attained such a height or stature. Though it was hard to tell in the wavering emerald-hued light, the figure appeared to be at least 7 feet tall, sitting down. The figure was outfitted with a weird array of trappings: a threadbare buffalo hide cloak, a beaded belt, and rotting boot moccasins. On its head, canted at a jaunty angle, dented and dull with age, was a casque from the days of Coronado and his conquistadores. A dented breastplate from the same era encased the torso. Lances decorated with feathers and beads leaned against the side of the throne, and at its feet were shattered, rust-eaten matchlocks. The skin of the figure was brown and stretched drum tight over the bones. The shadows the shimmering light cast across the mummified face lent it an expression of indescribable, inhuman ferocity.
Is this Nana Bozho?
Yes. Nana Bozho. Unchi.
JB and Ryan recognized the word for grandmother. Ryan continued to stare at the figure atop the hand-hewn altar. He was sweating, and his heart threatened to glide up his throat. He remembered what Joe and Shishoka had told him of the cavern's history, and though he hadn't flatly disbelieved it, he hadn't truly accepted it either. If the history was true, then what Mildred had theorized about the nature of the energy trapped within the cavern might also have truth to it.
Mildred, is this like the quantum stream stuff you were talking about?
Quantum? Oh, God, Ryan, I don't know. Physics isn't really my field. But now to see this, I don't know what the hell it is, and I'm afraid to find out.
What do you think about the giant?
Maybe the first people were the sources of legends about giants in the earth, the Gregari mentioned in the Bible.
Christy moved forward, walking around the edge of the floor that overlooked the lip of the well. She stepped down and walked toward the rim.
Christy, what are you doing?
I want to know what the hell it is. And I'm not afraid to find out.
Christy, that light wavelength could be radioactive for all we know.
Christy reached the outer edge of the crystal-studded golden wafers arranged on the floor. As Ryan rushed toward her, she knelt and pressed her forehead against a crystal.
Christy?
She didn't respond, didn't seem to hear. At the same time, the dancing pattern of the light changed. It leapt, then sank, and the strobing effect slowed. The green color deepened. Ryan reached Christy, his fingers biting her arms as he pulled her back and up. Her eyes were slightly glazed. Everyone crowded around them.
Christy, are you all right?
What I saw.
Saw what? You touched the crystal for a second. You didn't answer when I called you.
The ancestors of all the tribes, leaving this valley and spreading out over Earth.
She hugged herself. Ryan tried to put an arm around her shoulders, but she pushed it away impatiently.
An entire culture based on science of the mind, of wholeness with nature and the planet itself.
That's what you saw?
The crystal discs. They're sculpted memory crystals, like the ones used in the computer databases in the redoubts. I accessed the entire history of this place, and even what I can't explain, I understand deep down.
Does this energy source bear any resemblance to Dr. Wyeth's hypothesis? Is it a manifestation of the quantum stream?
It is the heart of the grandmother.
Yes, and no. It's both and neither. The information I accessed is chaotic, but at least I can make a pretty good guess to its true nature. It is a focal point of Earth energy. What Shishoka calls the grandmother and I call Gaia.
Are you saying this light is sentient? Self-aware?
It's more than light. My mother taught me that a harmony, a balance exists between energy forces we can't see, but it still affects us. Ancient peoples constructed megalith structures to serve as conductors of the Earth energy. This power was utilized to aid the propagation of crops, fertility, and good fortune. I saw that what's in this cave is a natural phenomenon, a hub of geomagnetic energy. It's the external manifestation of what used to be called geofire.
That does not answer my question.
Doc, your question can't be answered. Those lights? That's the only answer you're gonna get.
Why did Shishoka's people worship this place if it's not supernatural?
It is, in a way.
Christy smiled wanly, glancing toward a puzzled Shishoka.
I saw that her ancestors knew how to interact with the energy. They existed in a cause and effect relationship, like dropping a stone into a still pond, which causes ripples of water to spread out in circles. The first people figured out how to work with the naturally occurring crystals, and through the enhanced electromagnetic energy of their brains, they manipulated the geofire on a non-physical level in such a way as to affect the physical level.
I get it. Quantum theory states that all physical forms are of energy, but vibrating at different rates. Nothing exists in a vacuum. So when the first people and their direct descendants focused their thoughts accidentally at first, I'll bet they interacted with the vibrational field of the geoenergy. The field absorbed, then carried the intentions of their thoughts. The more focused the intention, the more empowered was the vibrational wave of the geoforce to affect changes in their physical environment. Well, that doesn't explain everything, but it explains most of the mysteries of Tiratwa, including the intelligent wolves. Over the centuries, belief in the kinship with the animals manifested itself in a human-level intelligence in them.
So Joe was right. It's a power that he can manipulate.
No, he was wrong. What he wanted to do was to make an overnight change all over the planet. That can't be done. The energy is focused in this valley, and one man, no matter how willful, can't bend the Earth powers to do his bidding. Tiratwa evolved over centuries, and it became what it was due to concerted, generational effort.
Ryan gazed at the glow and tried to absorb all that he had heard. It still sounded fantastic, but no more than many other things he'd heard and seen in his life. Peasy had said that much ancient knowledge from the first people had been lost, and Ryan realized with a sense of sadness. The Tiratwa that had so entranced him was but a mere shadow of its former glory.
Touch the sky comes now.
Ryan pivoted on his heel and looked toward the steps leading up through the stone opening. He couldn't see anything, yet he trusted the wolf's instincts.
How many?
Blood sniffer smells 8.
So, 7 of them made it over the bridge. Or they found another way. I'll try to get them as they come through the passage. Triple red, everybody!
Ryan gave no one the opportunity to object, but as he ran toward the stone stairs, Bloodsniffer bounded at his side. Man and Wolf exchanged a glance, then they crept into the shadowy mouth of the opening. At the top of the steps, Ryan crouched, gun in one hand, the other restraining Bloodsniffer's taut, shaggy body. The 6-hour had a full clip, but only 3 rounds remained in his gun belt. He couldn't afford to fire bullets indiscriminately. Every shot had to find a target.
Not yet. Not yet.
Ryan waited, counting seconds silently. He couldn't lift his head above the round entrance without giving away his position. So he waited until he felt sure they were only yards away.
Ochine!
Hello, Ryan.
Shit! Move!
Ryan bolted down the stairs, bullets flying all around him. They burst into the cavern, Ryan cursing himself for having only taken out 1 warrior with the 3 shots. Bloodsniffer's hair bristled, and his fangs gleamed. He was angry, and Ryan wouldn't have blamed him for sinking his teeth into his ass. He and the wolf ran along the walkway bordering the well, and reached the others on the far side, near the base of the ziggurat.
They're still coming. Now.
We're ready for them.
I think Tarawa dies tonight. If it does, I have no wish to live in a world without it.
They waited a couple of minutes, but nobody came down the stairs. Joe and his companions hadn't come out into the Cavern of Creation. Ryan knew why. They were afraid of being outgunned.
Ochine! Are you ready to stop behaving like a fool?
How'd you get here, Joe?
I lost 2 men on that booby-trapped bridge. But farther down, we found a ledge that almost spans the chasm. I knew that from my research into the legends, something Shishoka evidently forgot or never knew. Ochine, you joined the losing side. You and your friends are trapped. But I see no reason to kill you. Give yourselves up, and you and your people are free to leave Tirawa.
You let Shishoka go with us?
No! She stays here where she belongs.
Why? Aren't you the guardian? What do you need her for?
That's no concern of yours.
Ha! I think you're afraid, Joe, to mess with this place without having the hereditary guardian on a string. You know your claim is bogus, and you want to cover all your bets.
Your answer?
There's nothing in the cavern that will do you any good. A light show, an old mummy, lots of crystal, gold, and silver. But you're not interested in that anyway. The power you crave isn't here.
Beside you, one-eyed bastard! Don't waste any more of my time! Decide to die in there or not, I'm sick of talking to you!
Ryan thought swiftly. This situation wasn't much different from the one in which Hatchet Jack roared a similar ultimatum. And like then, Ryan still had 1 ace on the line. It wasn't a particularly good one, but it was worth playing.
I don't trust your pals, Joe! We'll give our blasters to you if you come to us. Only you! Alone!
There was a long silence. So long that Ryan was on the verge of repeating his words.
All right, I'll come to you. Remember, if you kill me, all of you will die. My warriors will bottle you up in there until you perish of starvation or thirst.
Ryan patted Bloodsniffer's head. The wolf looked up at him, its eyes showing comprehension, then slunk around to the left, past the ziggurat. It took up a position on the far side of the well, where its lean, shaggy form was hidden by the green radiance pouring upward. Joe stepped out onto the walkway. He had his automatic rifle in hand, and he froze, gaping at the well, at the ziggurat. His head was tilted back, and his mouth slowly fell open in awe and astonishment. That was the instant Bloodsniffer charged him.
Help!
Joe's shots went high over the wolf. Bloodsniffer's jaws flew open, saliva tracing an arc in the air. Suddenly, 3 of the warriors charged out onto the walkway. 1 of the warriors was Little Mountain. They didn't know whether to look at Joe and the wolf or the heart of Grandmother Earth. They opted to stare with fear-widened eyes at the green blaze. This time, Ryan aimed. 2 men fell, but Little Mountain had skirted to the side. The man's left shoulder dissolved in a gout of blood and sheer tissue. He tried to clap a hand over the wound as he kicked himself backward toward the stairwell. Ryan was already running before Little Mountain reached the first step. He was trying to draw a bead on Joe, but the man was in a clinch with Bloodsniffer, and they were rolling together over the walkway. Ryan got to within 5 feet of Joe, just as the lithe, muscular man managed to swing the barrel of the rifle up and around. The rifle spat a narrow tongue of fire, and the bullet chunked into Ryan's right wrist. Just below the swelling muscles of his forearm, blood sprayed, slicking the butt of the Sig Sauer, and Ryan felt a shock in the soles of his feet. His fingers immediately lost all sensation and strength, and his gun clattered to the stone walkway. Ryan shut out the pain shooting through his right arm and pounced on Joe. Peripherally, Ryan glimpsed more warriors running down the steps, bows at the ready. Arrows sailed through the air, and JB, Christy, Mildred, Jack, and Doc plunged from behind the ziggurat, running along opposite sides of the walkway. Ryan couldn't risk glancing at the battle. He had problems of his own. Ryan pressed on Joe's rifle with his knees, trapping it lengthwise between the Indian's hands and his chest. They were locked too closely for the warriors to risk losing a flight of arrows, but the Lakota raced forward with knives and short-stabbing spears. In the corner of his eye, Ryan saw a bare-chested man stagger backward, a crimson spray jetting from a bullet-severed carotid. Instinctively, Ryan turned to Christie's voice. He saw her back against the curving cavern wall, slowly sliding toward the floor of the walkway. Her left hand was pressed against her chest, just below her left breast. A feathered shaft jutted between splayed fingers. She kept her hand there as she eased into a sitting position, as though she were trying to catch the blood. The barrel of her Smith & Wesson dropped against the stone. For an instant, their eyes met. Christie's showed a dull green in the bright green glow. Ryan saw death in them. Then Doc was at her side. Mildred set her sights on the warrior who loosed the arrow. Ryan blinked back the cloud of gray the kick in his ribs had just brought to his vision.
Uchine!
Little Mountain loomed directly over him, his muscular torso streaked with a sliding stream of scarlet. He held a tomahawk back over his head. Bullet holes sewed dark little periods across the Indian's pectorals. Ryan looked to Joe. The boar of the Gewehr inscribed a short half arc and centered on Ryan's face, staring at him with a hollow, cyclopean eye. Ryan locked eyes with his murderer. Joe squeezed the trigger. No jet of flame spat from the muzzle. No bullet careened out to end his life. Touch the sky was out of ammo.
No!
Ryan's left hand struck out, closing tightly around Joe's throat. The Lakota grimaced, and his own hand darted to Ryan's neck. They struggled, half-sliding, half-rolling toward the lip of the well and the curtain of green radiance. Fighting to their knees, they locked together like statues. Ryan exerted all of his strength in his arm, his fingers tight around the slim column of Joe's neck. The Lakota sought to tighten his double-handed grip on Ryan's throat. Their veins stood out on their temples. Their hair was damp. Sweat poured down their faces. Fear suddenly flooded Joe's eyes as his face darkened, taking on a purplish tint. Ryan's fingers ground deeper into the man's throat tendons, crushing them in upon jugular and windpipe. Joe's left hand swatted down for Ryan's right, which lay bent and numb at his waist. Joe's fingers closed over the ripped bloody flesh of Ryan's wrist, over the shattered bone. He squeezed, twisted, and yanked. Ryan wasn't even aware of his fingers slackening, of his body sagging to the floor. His entire body seemed to literally fly apart. The pressure on his wrist eased, the wave of agony drew back, and his senses returned in a piecemeal fashion. His arms and legs were back where they belonged, and so was his eye. And there was Joe, leaning over him, his face a blood-smeared mask of savage satisfaction.
Win. Ichiante. Mawaste.
Joe fumbled at Ryan's hip, and distantly, as though he were watching a not very interesting play, it occurred to Ryan that Joe was seeking to draw his own punga, the better to cut his throat. Then Joe's body lurched, his eyes flying wide, flicking down to stare in horrified incredulity at the spear haft that projected from his upper right chest, the slim column of wood standing up at a 45-degree angle from just below his collarbone. His hands came up and wonderingly traced the pattern of rawhide thongs wrapped around it.
Taku ehe kin ekta
swiveling his head slightly. Looking up, Ryan saw Shishoka standing atop the ziggurat, in front of the enthroned cadaver. She had hurled one of the old decorative lances through the veil of shimmering light. Her face was tear-stained, enraged, grief-stricken, all at the same time. Joe looked to have trouble standing up, his muscles convulsed. The thick pain fog in Ryan's mind was scattered by an eruption of fury, the old homicidal rage that always waited in a corner of his subconscious to jump in and take over. His left hand shot up, closed around the spear haft, and heaved up on it. Ryan pulled down on it, forcing himself to stand. Muscle and flesh tore, wood grated against bone, and a torrent of blood poured from the wound. Once upright, Ryan hooked the wooden shaft above his left elbow and lifted. Joe rose up into the air, like a buffalo hump steak impaled on a skewer. His moccasin feet kicked at empty air as Ryan took one hesitant step after another toward the well. Joe vanished into the fountain of light, touched the sky, quickly faded from sight. The light shifted, shimmering, the color sliding from yellow to orange, then to a deep, deep red. Ryan lifted his face from the gold and silver plates.
Give my regards to Grandma, you bastard.
He staggered over to Christy. The arrow was planted deep in her chest, right below her heart. Her eyes didn't open.
Will she live?
Mildred didn't answer. She was grimly probing the flesh around the sprouting shaft.
Will she live?
Christy's eyes flicked open.
Yes. Oh.
Only Ryan and Christy had suffered wounds in the fight. Bloodsniffer was dead, and Ryan found himself mourning the great gray wolf, as he would a human friend. But he couldn't allow himself to dwell on the loss. Though racked with pain, he kept his mind focused on Christy's condition. In the aftermath of the battle, JB, Doc, and Jack dragged the bodies of Joe's warriors up the steps and into the sacrificial cave. They placed Bloodsniffer's corpse there as well, after wrapping it in a robe taken from the cadaver on the ziggurat. The three of them had gone to backtrack Joe, searching for the method he used to jump the chasm. Ryan knew they couldn't bear to see Christy in pain, and they welcomed the opportunity to perform a task, any task, so they wouldn't have to consider the likelihood of her death. With Shishoka's help, Mildred carried Christy over to the base of the ziggurat, laying her on a pallet made of pelts taken from the throne. Ryan was too numb to thank Shishoka for throwing the ancient spear and saving his life. He knew that if Christy died, Shishoka's effort wouldn't make that much difference to him. Ryan shook his head angrily. Pain jumped around the walls of his skull. He recognized the symptoms of shock, and he wasn't surprised by them. The ulna and radial bones of his wrist were shattered, and his arm was dead up to the elbow. The bullet had missed major veins and arteries, but the delicate network of nerves was damaged. Neither he nor Mildred had any idea if the damage was permanent. She hadn't had the time to give his wound more than a cursory examination. Standing up, moving away from Christy, Mildred led Ryan aside. Her dark eyes misted.
The arrow is too deep, too close to her heart. It can't be withdrawn without major blood loss and organ damage. If she's moved, the arrowhead will open up arteries, and she'll bleed to death internally.
Something can be done.
In an operating room, with decent equipment and a staff of specialists and heart surgeons standing by, yes. But not here.
Yes, here. The heart of the grandmother will heal her heart.
No more mystical rants, please. This is a surgical matter, not a ceremony for the corn to grow straight and juicy.
Wait, Mildred. Christy said Shishoka's ancestors exerted their force of will on the geofire to change their physical surroundings.
So?
Maybe we can exert our own force of will on it to keep Christy alive, to heal her.
We'd be laying her life on the line.
It already is. Shishoka, you know how to do this?
The technique has been known and practiced by my people for ages. But all of us must take part. There must be no resistance to the chosen intent.
There won't be.
JB, Doc, and Jack returned within the hour. They had followed an outthrusting finger of rock that crossed the chasm, and gone on through the tunnels for a wreck.
Joe's warriors are gone, chilled or run back to the forest city. The wolf soldiers are coming back, even though their camp is burned out. I managed to get one of them to understand Joe was dead, and they're marching on the city to retake it.
We have acquired water skins and nourishment.
Good thinking.
I assumed we would be unable to leave for a time.
How Christy now?
She'll live, but all of us will have to work at it. I'll let Chishoka explain.
We need all of you to join. Kneel and press against the wall.
Like when we first spoke to Bloodsniffer.
Oh, my back will certainly not appreciate this.
Do it for Christy.
On my honor, my dear Ryan, I shall endure any hardship for our compatriot.
The process began that very hour, everyone focusing his or her thoughts on healing Christy's wound, envisioning her whole, alive and vibrant. It wasn't easy for such tough, pragmatic minds accustomed to dealing with a harsh, uncompromising reality to invoke their imaginations, but all of them did their best. The process took a week, and the passage of days and nights ceased to have any meaning to the people within the Cavern of Creation. To Ryan, the hours blurred into an endless montage of kneeling, concentrating, envisioning, hoping, dreaming. He barely ate or drank or shaved or bathed. It wasn't important. Sometimes, when he was kneeling and focusing, there seemed to be too much light above him. It would move and pulse and swim to the movement of his blood, match the rhythm of his heartbeat. Other times, the light seemed too dim, and he was angrily aware that his mind was drifting down other paths, floating into unwanted channels. The pain of his wrist impaired his concentration. One day, he was sure he heard a million little bells chiming softly, the cheerful sound speaking of love and kindness. On another occasion, he saw Joe and John Hatcher striding out of the green light, entering his mind, moving side by side like a pair of lions. Ryan thought hard and swatted them away. Then, on another day, Ryan realized his fingers were hurting, and he was able to flex them. It occurred to him that perhaps an overspill of the green energy of the geofire was healing his wound, but he didn't want to remove the splint made of wood and rawhide to check on it. He didn't need any more distractions. Christy stayed calm, quiet, and dignified during the entire process. She drank and ate whenever she was offered food and water, and she didn't touch the arrow in her chest. When he wasn't kneeling and concentrating, Ryan stayed by her side. She rarely spoke, though she wrinkled her nose at his odor.
Ryan?
Yes, Christy?
I've had a long life. None of it wasted, lover.
It's not over.
You and me, together. A long time. Shining times, lover.
Yeah. Shining times.
Then, one day, and Ryan had no idea if it was day or night, morning or afternoon, Chishoka pulled him away from the well rim and led him over to where Mildred knelt beside Christy. Her face was startlingly pale, surrounded by her thick cloud of red hair, but her eyes were bright, more brilliant than the green geofire.
Now we will learn if our intentions were pure.
Chishoka grabbed the feathered shaft that stood out from under Christy's breast.
Wait, what are you...
The arrow came free as easily and as smoothly as if it had been lodged in cotton wadding. Black fluid bubbled from the puncture wound, then came a flow of bright red blood. Mildred, her eyes dull with fatigue but registering astonishment, plugged the puncture with a mixture of buffalo tallow and yarrow. No blood seeped around the edges of the wound. Chishoka touched Christy's face three times in a ritualistic fashion.
You are well now.
Christy, how do you feel?
I feel fine. I can feel it, Ryan. I'm gonna be okay.
It was the third morning after they had left the cavern, and they were guests in the forest city. All of them had been given separate rooms. Ryan, in particular, was far too grateful for a place to bathe and rest to think about their next course of action.
Ryan?
Yeah?
How's your wrist?
It's a little stiff, but I can feel things again, and my fingers move fine. I don't know how it happened, but I think it's just about completely healed. You?
Christy sat up in bed, her hair tumbling about her bare shoulders and breasts. Only a faint, puckered scar showed where the arrow had pierced her.
Shishoka gave me some aloe juice and told me to apply it regularly. The scar should be gone in about a month.
That's great.
So, how long are we going to stay here?
That depends on how long you want to stay.
If it was up to me, I'd say for the rest of our lives.
Well, why isn't it up to you?
Well, the others might not see it that way. Maybe not feel we should stay in this place. And besides, there may be other factors involved.
Like what?
I don't know. I sense something.
Well, let's get dressed and figure out just what that is.
A few minutes later, they stepped from their quarters into the cool air. JB, Mildred, Doc, and Jack were already outside, their faces downcast. Shishoka was with them. Ryan immediately felt a change in the city's attitude. The past 2 days and nights had carried with them a snap of good spirits, almost a buoyancy. The wolf soldiers had retaken the city 2 weeks before without meeting any resistance. With Touch the Sky dead, the whole basis of his campaign had been swept away. The Cavern Keeper Society was sick with guilt. They vowed to redress their grave wrong and to make Tirawa the Valley of Peace again. Much of the valley was blackened and blasted by fire, though the land near the Forest City was untouched. The companions had missed the ritual period of mourning the dead while in the cavern, and when they arrived back in the city, they were greeted pleasantly enough. Now, this day, the air of mourning seemed to have returned. Ryan and Christy approached Shishoka, and they saw that she was dressed in her costume of office, a long buckskin dress, leggings adorned with tufts of fox fur, and a necklace made from alternating discs of gold and silver hung from her throat. A buffalo robe was draped about her shoulders. Her dark eyes were inscrutable.
You can go now. You can go from Tirawa with clear consciences. You redeemed any guilt that was yours in bringing death to the valley.
We could stay to help keep Tirawa as it is.
Shishoka's eyes searched Ryan's face, then all of their faces.
No. The stain, the taint, is upon you. The valley cannot fully recover, cannot completely heal in your presence.
Girl, we bled for Tirawa.
And you spilled far more blood than you shed. It will take a long time for that blood to be absorbed back into the heart of the Grandmother. Until that time, all of you will be a reminder to my people of how close we came to turning her land of happiness into a land of horror.
Her eyes softened, and she laid a hand on Christie's arm and on Ryan's wrist.
I regret this. I truly do. But it is my duty as guardian to protect the valley. It won't be forever. Grandmother Earth will heal, as she always has, and banish the demons of hatred and greed and ambition.
Under the watchful eye of several wolf soldiers, the six companions collected their mounts from the compound and prepared to leave. Shishoka stepped in front of Ryan's horse.
Piladaya, Ryan Gador. Wakantanka, Nichi Un.
They rode out of the Forest City, passing silent men and women and children. At the grasslands, they turned toward the mountain pass.
Ryan, what did Shishoka say to you?
Goodbye, and may the Great Spirit go with you and guide you.
Their horses carried them across the plain. The colors of the sun danced across the snow-capped mountain peaks. A breeze, bearing a refreshing hint of autumn, ruffled their hair and the manes of their horses. The soft blue mountain ranges rose beyond the grasslands. A hawk glided lazily across the face of the sun. All of the companions were content to simply ride quietly and observe and listen to the life-rich valley.
The gates of Eden have swung shut again, and the demons have been given the boot.
Not funny, Doc.
It wasn't meant to be, John Barrymore.
They reached the slope that crept up to the pass, and they urged their ponies forward, reining them to stop on the shelf of rock overlooking the valley. Ryan gazed at the great piles of white clouds, the wind-ruffled grasses, then to the charred, fire-blackened tract. Christy touched his arm. Though she was still a little pale, she was strong, alive, and healed.
Are you okay, lover?
It was peaceful here. Might have been good
to stay a while longer.
We can come back. The promise of returning to Tiratwa is a very strong inducement to staying alive.
What'll we do until then?
What we always do. What we've always done. What we do best. Survive.
In Deathlands, I reckon that's the best we can hope for.
It is the devil and the uncharitable votes of hell that desire our misery in the world to come.
Damn, Doc. I liked your ride boldly ride stuff better.
Me too.
Well then, let's do that very thing. There was nothing more to say. Ryan turned his pony's head away from Tiwawa and kept his back to the valley as he led his friends through the pass. Deathlands, Demons of Eden is a Graphic Audio production.